from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. His slightest utterance can move markets, the Wall Street Journal once said about George Gilder. The 1990s techno-visionary and founder of the Gilder Report railed against regulation and saw vast potential and profit in fiber optics and wireless technology. Then the bubble burst and Gilder's empire collapsed. Tonight on Point, surveying the wreckage and why George Gilder still sees a bright future for the high-tech industry. First, President Bush faced tough questions today from reporters in a Rose Garden press conference. It was only the 10th press conference by President Bush in 3 years. One reporter referred back to the president's May 1st speech on board the USS Abraham Lincoln when Bush announced the end to major combat operations in Iraq. She asked if his announcement was premature. The president had this response.
I think you ought to look at my speech. I said, Iraq's a dangerous place, and we've got hard work to do. There's still more to be done. And we had just come off a very successful military operation. I was there to thank the troops. The mission accomplished sign, of course, was put up by the members of the USS Abraham Lincoln saying that their mission was accomplished. I know it was attributed somehow to some ingenious advance man for my staff. They weren't that ingenious, by the way. But my statement was a clear statement, basically recognizing that this phase of the war for Iraq was over, and there was a lot of dangerous work, and it's proved to be right. It is dangerous in Iraq.
Earlier today, I spoke with Maura Reynolds, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I asked her to describe the tone of the president's press conference today.
I think he was defensive. You don't see this president very often on the defensive, but I think that's really what we saw today.
This is only the 10th press conference of this administration, the first in 3 months. Why did President Bush come out to the Rose Garden on this day?
I think there were a few factors. There is just a simple timing issue, and that is he was just out of the country for an entire week, and a lot of what he did in Asia didn't quite make the front pages at the top of the news broadcast. And now he's about to go off on another 5-day trip, largely focused on fundraising, and where he will also be out of the public eye. And I think he wanted to seize the opportunity to actually try to get his message across. I think the other thing is that 2 days of very bad news out of Iraq needed some kind of a response.
So what were the president's most important messages today?
The White House has been on this campaign really since the end of the summer to try and say that all of the bad news out of Iraq is really just an unnatural focus of the news media, and that, in fact, the news is quite good if only the news media would tell you it. The thing is that 2 days of very prominent bombings against U.S. and international targets, including his own Deputy Secretary of Defense, is a little bit hard to say that's just a conspiracy of the news media. And I think this was their effort to try to put their spin on it, which is, we know it's dangerous. We went into Iraq knowing it's dangerous, but we're determined to do the job anyway.
So it's not easy over there, but the president signaled that he sees no need for additional U.S. troops. How did he signal that exactly?
Well, he said that if there's any need for troops, he expects the request to come from the Pentagon. But this is an ideological divide within this administration, and the Pentagon insists that they can both do this job and that they can do it without additional troops, and they're sticking by their guns.
He also declined to say, though, whether he thought there might be fewer American troops in Iraq a year from now.
Yes, he, in fact, said it was a trick question, which was a bit unfair, I thought, to the questioner. It was an effort to get him on the record about something that Americans care about, which is the extent of the deployment. He just refused to answer it because he doesn't want to be on the record about it. The fact of the matter is he doesn't know what's going to happen in the next year in Iraq, the same as you and I don't. And he doesn't want to make a promise that he can't keep by saying, no, there absolutely won't be more troops.
And to this question about, he was asked, we heard at the top, whether he would acknowledge that he was premature in making remarks about the end of major combat operations. Was he, in effect, trying to walk away from what he said on the deck of the USS Lincoln?
Well, yes and no. What he said in the press conference is something that White House aides have been saying for a while, and that is that the mission accomplished sign wasn't the White House's idea. It was the idea of the sailors on board the ship who had planned to put that up to say that their mission was accomplished.
But the president did say on that day, my fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Well, I really don't think there's any question that the message that they wanted to send on that day was that the mission was accomplished, or they wouldn't have allowed that banner to hang up. So I think that this is a certain amount of backpedaling by the White House, and it is in part because they're on the defensive. What the president said was, if you read my speech, you would see that I also said that Iraq is a dangerous place. And to be frank, he did say that.
Mm-hmm.
He did say that it would continue to be hard. The problem is there's always, you know, a glass half empty and a glass half full, and both things are right at the same time.
Maura Reynolds, what's the tenor or texture of relations between the Bush administration and the White House press corps at this point? Is the war in Iraq putting more pressure on that relationship? Is it deteriorating?
Well, I think that the press corps themselves have long felt shut out by this White House and have felt that this White House is not particularly respectful. So the feelings among the press corps towards the White House, I don't think, have changed particularly. But I do think that the White House has made things a little tenser in the last 2 months by accusing the news media of, quote-unquote, filtering the news. My response to that is, well, that's exactly what we do. It's our job to listen to the speeches in their full length and to read the transcripts and to attend meetings and whatever, and then tell you, filter out what's important in that. But the way that the White House has tried to present it is that we are the problem, that the media is the problem. In other words, that they've got a communications problem, not a policy problem. And what they're discovering, I think, is something that many administrations discover when the news coverage of their policies goes bad, that what you think is a communications problem is often a policy problem. And the fact that questions are being raised about the policy right now does not just necessarily mean that the news media has for some reason turned against you.
But for the time being, the president, at least rhetorically, and more than that, is standing firm. He says Iraq and Afghanistan will be stable, independent nations and their people will live in freedom. He's signaling complete resolve.
Well, that's what he does. I mean, this president is very, very consistent. He has a few positions and a few core principles, and he sticks to them and does not change them. And that is one of them. His language on that has not changed.
Maura Reynolds, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Maura Reynolds is White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me from Washington. George Gilder's remarkable career has spanned the realms of technology, economics, politics, and prophecy. He was a speechwriter for Richard Nixon and Nelson Rockefeller and later an advisor to Newt Gingrich. His best-selling 1981 book, Wealth and Poverty, Championing the Virtues of Capitalism and Entrepreneurship, was a core text of the Reagan Revolution. In 1996, he started the Gilder Technology Report, the must-read telecommunications newsletter for industry insiders and fevered stock pickers, where he heaped praise on companies like Global Crossing and WorldCom. The newsletter's circulation ballooned to 110,000. Gilder's influence in the boom reached much wider. Then the stocks he blessed came down like the Hindenburg, and so did Gilder's fortunes. Now, after some hard, low-profile years, George Gilder is speaking up again, and he's still in love with technology and the creative spark that lights up the future. Was George Gilder your guru in the internet boom years? Do you blame him for helping fill the bubble? Are you ready again for his siren song? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is George Gilder, founder of the Gilder Technology Report. Good evening and welcome.
Good to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Hey, Jack, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Nice to have you with us.
And also have my daughter here from Hanover. Well,
George Gilder, it's remarkable to be sitting with you. You hovered over the 90s like some kind of god of that decade. I was at events where you spoke to rapt audiences, people hanging on every word. You clearly had a great big burning vision. Some parts of it, you're saying, worked out, and some angles clearly did not. Can you catch us up with your personal history? After the Gilder report kind of tipped over the edge along with the stock market, lots of subscribers left. What's the George Gilder story from that moment forward?
Well, I believe that the predictions about the Internet and the all optical networks, the impact of the Internet, the impact of broadband, the feasibility of broadband, that's full motion video over the Internet, have all been vindicated. They all just moved to Asia. You know, the environment in the United States turned intensely hostile. And so the Internet moved to Asia. And Korea today has 40 times more bandwidth per capita than we do, 40 times more bandwidth to homes and households and small businesses than we do. And fully a third of the Korean economy now is transacted on the Internet, which is more than we ever projected for the United States, except in very long-term prophecies. So the idea that the Internet concept and the all-optical network was some wild bubble, I think, is just false.
Well, I think when people say the bubble, they're referring to a stock market bubble, and that fairly well was clear and fairly well went away.
Well, I mean, I think that there were overvaluations, as they always are, but 1,000 telecom bankruptcies was not created by a stock market bubble. That was created by a regulatory clamp, which essentially halted deployment of fiber in the local loop and also brought the telecosmic deployments to a halt as a result of deflation. What happened between 1996 and 2000 was about a 30 to 35% increase in the value of the dollar against gold and commodities and other currencies, the yen, the euro, whatever. And what deflation does is it punishes debtors, and the biggest debtors in the world were the telecom companies that were deploying infrastructure to accommodate what turned out to be a 9,000-fold rise in Internet traffic during that period.
So you want to lay this at the feet of regulation that slowed down a kind of natural growth that would have, in your view, justified the sky-high stock market valuations of the late 90s?
Not all. The stock market's constantly appraising the value of all these companies.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the companies involved in the so-called bubble were launched on the assumption that there would be broadband connections to homes all over the United States by now.
We'll come to that, but take us to the very prosaic for a moment here, because you were so enormous. What was it like when this thing tumbled off the cliff? We'll come back to the reasons.
Okay.
But you must have had people fleeing that newsletter
thousands. I mean, it was just an incredible catastrophe for my company. I mean, I had five newsletters that I had launched over that period.
A staff of 55, investment bankers wanted to take you public.
Yeah, I was supposed to go public. My company was appraised at a value of some close to $200 million.
Ooh, wasn't it fun?
It was just really an absolute amazing fantasy siege.
And then it all came down. The taxes came due, and now there are liens on your home, your farm.
I'm having great fun.
Saying you're going to be working for the rest of your life for the IRS.
I bought back my company for $9.5 million from the two partners, from my two earlier partners. Just before things crashed. And I managed to pay them close to $8 million, but I owed an additional million, and that additional million in a time of deflation was impossible to pay. So I was sued by people all over the place. I mean, I had a ball. I mean, it was really
no fun at all.
Well, it was it had its virtues. It provoked me to write. I've written almost three books since then. So.
We'll talk about that. Listeners, can you still hear the fire? We're talking tonight with George Gilder, techno champion, ecstatic capitalist, visionary, and victim of the high-tech boom and bust. Was George Gilder your guru in the Internet boom years, and are you still open to that siren song? Do you blame him for helping fill the bubble? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm joined in the studio tonight by George Gilder, techno champion, ecstatic capitalist, visionary, and victim, you might say, of the high-tech boom and bust of the 90s. And after, you can join our conversation tonight. Did you make a bundle on Gilder's tips? Did you lose a bundle? Do you buy his view that regulation stifled the boom? And George Gilder still sees a mountain of technology potential. Are you on board in this lifetime? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, I know you're sitting there in New Hampshire, and you can no doubt feel the energy that George Gilder always has given off and still does, even on this side of everything. This is a guy who's really on fire with the vision, always has been.
Yes, and, you know, he's the rare case of a writer. I mean, at least I think of him originally as a writer, a thinker, who went into practical matters, went into the stock market, went into technology, and made himself expert on this and became... he's an American type, the booster. He's taken it to a higher level, I think, adding in a kind of Vatic or oracular overlay. But this is a very familiar figure in American history, the person, the prophet of a new turn in technology. And, you know, the basic reality of the American economy for the last 100-odd years has been the giant corporation. And so long as that's true, the economies of scale and scope rule. And in climates of technological stability, they're all-powerful. But then there come these moments when new technology is invented, what comes along, and scale and scope don't matter a damn. You go out and start your own business, you leap around all that, and that's the moment for the entrepreneur, and that has been Mr. Gilder's moment, and the thing of which he's been celebrating, and that's a great part of the American economy, a great part of any economy. Its great economist Joseph Schumpeter defined it this way: he says the innovational process incessantly revolutionizes the economic structure from within, incessantly destroying the old one, incessantly creating a new one. That innovational spark happens when new technology comes, and what Max Weber called the iron cage of rationality that is capitalism. Otherwise, we're all subject to the market, law of supply and demand, calculation. All that is out the window because the new technology comes.
And there it came on like gangbusters. George Gilder, did you see the 90s as a rare window, as a limited time only engagement for entrepreneurship where technology burst things open? Is it going to open again, or does, I don't know, corporate giantism come back in and it heals, it seals over and it's gone?
Well, from I guess 78 to about 2000, the proportion of the economy that was represented by Forbes 500 companies dropped from about half of the economy to a quarter of the economy. So there was really a massive expansion of smaller companies that characterize this boom. And all booms are essentially characterized by new companies, because mature old companies don't grow at the pace that new companies do, and so it's new companies that create virtually all economic growth.
But you don't always have an internet coming along. You don't always have fiber optics coming along. Are the ingredients there for another decade of entrepreneurship? Or do you think Americans are too soured on that, and the backlog of optic fiber is too great, is clogging up the works?
Well, I think that in telecom, it's going to be slow for a while. I mean, we have really stomped on telecom in an overwhelming way. It's the most highly taxed industry in the United States, except for tobacco and alcohol. But it's taxed in a perverse way. Jack Hausman of MIT shows that Jerry Hausman shows that it costs $2 in lost telecom revenue for every dollar of taxes that are collected. It's regulated in 50 different states. They have two markets in each of those 50 states. So the whole telecom regulatory apparatus and all the lawyers that cling to it and
spearheaded it. So this is the piece you misjudged, George Gilder.
100 different jurisdictions to regulate.
And this is what you're saying gummed up the Gilder vision. This is what you missed. You imagined what? That all this bandwidth would open up and the economy would be...
I thought it would overcome the regulation. I thought the regulation would be blasted away by the energy and innovation that a 9,000-fold rise in internet traffic in 5 years implied, and 7 years. And it didn't... It didn't happen. It moved to Asia instead. It did happen in China. It's happening in Korea. This is a great moment for the world economy because of the fabulous explosive growth in Asia.
Now we had just last night we had on the show Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize winning economist. You know his new book is Looking Back at the 90s, the Roaring 90s, and he's coming at it from a different angle. He says, look, the problem here was, in his view, that deregulation went too far, that the balance between government, the kind of buffering impact of government, was diminished, and suddenly you got everything, wild and running out of the fences and speculation and everything out of whack, and it comes tumbling down.
Yeah, well, he thinks we're undertaxed and underregulated, and the implication is socialism, and if socialism really worked, we'd see some signs of it someday.
Socialism.
Maybe some century we'll see some signs of successful socialism.
But when
that happens, then Stiglitz will have a valuable insight.
But socialism, I don't think he's a socialist. I don't think he's really suggesting that. Are you saying that any kind of regulation is essentially socialism?
No, I'm saying that the idea that we were underregulated these days implies a socialist vision because we are massively labyrinthine regulations pervade our whole economy. We have an incredible cancer of capitalism manifested by the trial lawyers. We have it's just an incredible morass of regulations.
But the 90s will present
to say there isn't enough regulation implies a blindness that I associate with socialism. Now maybe that's an unfair characterization of Stiglitz. He's interesting about the IMF. He does see the IMF as destructive in the third world.
But the 90s reputation was as the decade when the harness came off, when deregulation was the way of the land. I mean that was the brand put on it.
Well, the deregulatory law of 1996, the Telecom Deregulation Act, as it was called, had 780,000 words in it. It was amended with about a million more words of interpretation. If you can imagine a deregulation that takes millions of words to define, that's not deregulation. We massively re-regulated in 1996.
Terrence is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Terrence. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't buy George's explanation that it's overregulation, not that I'm sympathetic to the regulation, but I think it's a little bit analogous to electric power industry. It's not the electric utilities that make the bulk of the money, if you will, in the economy. It's the companies and people using the electricity. So I think where the misestimation was in both the market and in reality was the thought that it was going to be the providers of broadband, the providers, the enablers of the Internet that were going to make all the rents, all the money. The Internet revolution is still here. It's just the content providers that are creating intellectual property. And I think it's sort of that diffusion of who's making the money that really was the change. And what we could have better foreseen was laying miles of cable is not a hard thing, particularly when there's ready financing available to imitate.
So the profit didn't show up where it was expected. George Gilder, what do you think?
That happened. I mean, I don't disagree with that. The money did not gravitate to telecom. I think if there had been a full broadband deployment of the sort, for example, that you see in Korea, we might have had be moving toward a third of the economy running over the Internet, and there would be a lot of residual profits collected by the people who create that infrastructure and maintain it and and run it.
Now, Korea is a funny example because I think of that as a country where the government's very influential. I mean, if broadband is common there, one almost guesses it's because of government dictate that it is.
Well, it's part of the what we don't understand here is we have a powerful negative force. Now, in Korea, they favor technology. They favor the internet. They favor broadband. And they have,
you're saying the United
to some
States
degree,
doesn't?
No. We tax telecom more than any other industry. You go to the U.S. Senate, and they treat communications as a sleepy time public utility. They're always talking in the images of the old black phone and the as if
different decade, different century.
They're in a different century. The people who run the internet in the United States are three octogenarians: Senators Hollings, Inouye, and Stevens of Alaska. They, who's chiefly concerned with getting some kind of service to the Inuit. And I don't oppose having service to the Inuit, but he's willing to twist the entire million-word regulatory apparatus in order to secure this minor goal from the long-term perspective.
That little matter. Matt's calling from Boston. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi. Calling. I was a senior executive with one of those companies that used, in fact, Mr. Gilder's projections about broadband usage in our IPO prospectus, where we successfully raised over $100 million. However,
I'm sure you weren't alone in citing George
Gilder.
Who
are you?
I was with an. I'd rather not name the company because we ended up not failing, and I would argue.
$100 million and boom, or bust. $100 million and bust.
Exactly, and I would argue that part of that was waiting for this broadband revolution. It was an online entertainment business, and usually you have the capital comes after the customers. In this case, we got the capital, but we couldn't get to the customers because the customers themselves couldn't get to broadband.
So you're seconding George Gilder's notion that it got choked up when people couldn't get access to the broadband service.
Yeah, and there were multiple businesses just like mine that just couldn't get to the finish line. The model worked as long as the customer could get the product.
So Matt, you're in an interesting position. $100 million raised and lost. George Gilder cited in your IPO prospectus. Do you end up thinking of George Gilder as a visionary or as the guy that got the timing out of sync here?
I think he had the right idea. I just think, one man can. It's hard to overcome what I believe to be an overly bureaucratic, apparatus.
Well, there's a vote for the Gilder view. Matt, thanks for your call. Mark's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, great. Thank you for taking my call. I have not met my introduction to Mr. Gilder was actually the green cover story of a Wired magazine back in 1998 or 99, and I worked actually in the technology industry from the inside as well. I actually was working at Forrester Research at the time. And my question really was, we talked a lot about the telecom boom and its impact on, or potential impact on the economy. And my question now is really, where does Mr. Gilder see the next disruptive wave, or the next really large game-changing technology coming from?
George Gilder.
Well, I think what's the big change that's happening is the rise in Asia, and it's real. And so what I see is that all these technologies invented, developed in the United States are moving to Asia, where they are in the process of creating fabulous amounts of wealth and change, and that they will come back to the United States via Asia. I'm writing a book called Crossroads that essentially expounds that proposition.
But you're not talking about a new disruptive technology there. You're saying the ones you've already put your finger on, this convergence of computers and telecom.
That's one. Obviously, there are a whole array of other technologies that are of vast importance, biotech, what they call nanotechnology, which is really an extension of the existing microelectronic technology, but has huge applications and potential. I mean, there are an array of new opportunities. But I do believe that that getting broadband to the United States generally is going to be still a huge opportunity and a huge upside for the next decade. It's going to take a long time. It requires overcoming this huge inertia of bureaucracy and litigation and regulation.
George Gilder, are you now making the telecosm vision a kind of national security or national competitiveness issue, saying Asia is going to adopt it and come back and whack the United States up the side of the head? Is this your way of putting a stick of dynamite under the Congress?
Well, maybe that's partly it. I mean, countries that embrace the next big technology do tend to eclipse countries that don't. So most of the companies that are spearheading this technology are still American. You know, they're all American technologies, often heavily created by immigrants, ironically. But they are American technologies. And so this has been a big boon for American companies in the face of the real paralysis in the United States.
That
the ability
to have
half the cell phones in the world are in China now, or 200 and not half this, but there's some 300 million cell phones in China now. Mm-hmm. And a big boom is going to be in putting cameras on all these cell phones. Cell phones
we
are
see
all
that happening already. Jack Beatty, here's the dream that doesn't die. And George Gilder looks at the 90s and says, what do you mean deregulation? That wasn't even half deregulated. That wasn't even a start on real deregulation.
Well, Mr. Stieglitz thought otherwise, and he instanced things like the financial markets that helped to lead to corporate scandals that impoverished many Americans. I don't think there's any question about that.
I reject that proposition that there was a special. There were corporate scandals. There are always corporate scandals, and a regulatory system that prohibited and thwarted all corporate scandals would also thwart all economic growth.
But you just discredited yourself when you said regulation is socialism. For heaven's sakes, we have lived with regulation in this economy since 1900, and it has made us the most prosperous economy in the world. Why? Because it has put borders around what even you would agree are the sort of unlimited cupidity of people, and to prevent one person from feeding on another. A little regulation, a little transparency goes a heck of a long way. And to call that socialism, I just think discredits your whole analysis.
That's fine. I did not call all regulation socialism. I think the key to regulation is it be stable and predictable. That is what you need. You need a structure, a legal structure that's stable and predictable for enterprise to prosper. The problem with the regulatory system that I was describing, millions of words of regulation in a industry which is being transformed by microelectronics, by Moore's Law, into the spearhead of change and dynamism of the world economy has been the problem. There was this...
George Gilder, hold the thought. We're talking with George Gilder, techno champion, still on fire. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with George Gilder, techno champion, ecstatic capitalist, visionary, and victim of the high-tech boom and bust. You can join the conversation. Is George Gilder a bona fide prophet here, or is he dignifying gambling, dressed up in adventure and ecstatic vision? And does capitalism need a George Gilder to celebrate the creative entrepreneur in a world of big corporations, of big regulation? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Alan's calling from Meadville, Pennsylvania. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Good evening. The point I wanted to make was right into the teeth of the last discussion between Mr. Gilder and Jack.
Yeah.
It was to the point of regulation. There's... The main device that provides broadband to consumers, whether it's rural consumers or urban, is in different terms. It's the DSL switch.
Yeah. Okay.
It's the device that's required in an office to provide that service to an area. Well, for example, if you have a manned office, it takes one regulation to be able, or one tariff to be able to provide that service out of a manned office. if you put the same device in an unmanned office or what we call a remote to feed rural customers and so forth,
okay,
you have to go back to the regulatory bodies and apply again under a completely different regulation or tariff.
So it sounds like you're in the telecom business and you're seconding George Gilder's view that it's bound up in regulation.
Exactly. There's a big debate in a lot of different areas about rural broadband allowing the digital, they call it the digital divide, where people in rural areas can't get to high-speed internet, and it's dragging down rural economies and so forth. But that's a different discussion.
We've got it, Alan, and we thank you for the observation. George Gilder, give us the picture then. If it can still happen, if somehow you could blast through this and get the broadband into every house, rural, urban, you name it, right. give us the George Gilder version now on the other side of stock market meltdown of what the telecosm looks like. What's the fine-tuning you've done?
Well, telecosm does mean that this dream of power to the people or whatever that was at the heart of it, where in general, it's not one to one or one to many. It is many to many model where anybody can publish, anybody can broadcast. It's just as the personal computer, just as gave to a single person at a workstation the kind of creative power that you needed to control a whole factory to command in the past. So,
is the actual usage of the internet confirming the vision that you're outlining there? I mean, isn't it kind of funneling down into fewer, bigger corporate run sites? I know there's tons of activity, but is it really bearing you out in this
vision?
Yes, it
is. I mean, it's just a tremendous proliferation of users of the internet. Supplying just a vast amount of information. I couldn't even function in Tyringham, Massachusetts, producing a whole series of newsletters based on information from companies all around the world and analysts all around the world. All are immediately available to me and permit me to become quite – now I'm a company of five people or less. I still have
you're
powerful.
All that flow coming in. Jack's calling from Wayland, Massachusetts. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask George Gilder, I mean, what is he using to really decide that there is so much, there's such an incredible pent-up demand for broadband? The reason I say that is because I have it. I know they're going to increase my 1.5 megabit service to 3. I really don't need it. One example I'd cite is that, My children's grandmother, she can hit send and go make a pot of coffee, and by then the pictures will be uploaded. She doesn't need it, and a lot of people just don't need it, in my opinion. How's he formulating this opinion, and what is he basing it upon?
So where's all the great demand lurking? Jack, thanks for your call, George Gilder.
Well, I think Americans now spend as many as 7 hours a day watching television. And all in order to capture their eyeballs for a few minutes of advertisements that most of the time they don't want to see. This is just a vast waste. It's not just a vast wasteland. It's a vast waste of human possibility. And what a real broadband internet would do would be to blast that top-down tool of tyrants of the television broadcasting.
Do you think it's going to happen?
Yes, it is. I wrote a book called Life After Television 10 years ago. It's increasingly happening. TiVo, all these new personal video recorders that essentially allow you to zap ads if you want, are already emancipating people from this tool of tyrants that the television industry represents.
And yet surely the end of the 90s showed us how many things can come and intervene. You're back with your Gilder Technology Report now. You're putting it out. You have been. And what I'm reading here in a recent New York Times story saying that somebody indexes the stocks that you cite and that they've been up
220% in the last year compared to 71% for the NASDAQ and 29% for the S&P. But you've said yourself, George Gilder, that people came out of the 90s and the stock market meltdown mad and aggrieved and pained and broke on George Gilder's advice. You said these people didn't lose 50% or 80% of their money. They lost 98% of their money. Why are you, of all the things you could do with your time, why are you back in the stock picking business?
Well, it's whether it's stock picking is, you know, I'm identifying technology paradigms, and I identify companies that accord with these paradigms. I encourage investment in companies that accord with the paradigms. I've identified a number of them, technologies that I support and I fervently endorse, and I hope that they do prevail. And if they do prevail, they will reward the people who invest in them. That's how capitalism works. And, you know, the Foveon camera, for example, is a new kind of imager invented by Carver Mead, who next week will receive a National Medal of Technology mm-hmm. in Washington. At age 67, he's come up with a radical new camera that collects all three colors at every pixel, so it just drastically improves the efficiency of all imagers and makes possible imagers in every cell phone and every ATM machine, for all sorts of new applications for imaging, which will be critical as the Internet does go broadband.
George Gilder, your old pal at Forbes, Richard Carlgaard, publisher there, says, George believes that scientists and entrepreneurs are almost doing the religious work of revealing the universe to us. Has he got that right?
I think that all uncovering of truth ultimately has religious implications, that the truth is revelation. Truth, God, is the foundation of reality in the universe. It's everything that we can't grasp that's beyond our reach. And as we science and technology does represent a kind of cumulative revelation of this truth.
And
of God's...
did the bust shake any part of your faith?
No. I mean, booms and busts are pervasive through the history of business. It didn't destroy any part of my faith, no.
And working for the IRS for the next God knows how many years
well,
to pay
we'll
off those back
we'll
taxes.
See what we could do about the IRS.
George Gilder, it's been great to have you. You are one of a kind. You've got Crossroads coming out about Asia. You've got another book, The Cat and the Camera. Is that right?
That's about the Foveon camera, which National Semiconductor and Synaptics now own a big chunk of.
And a third book you're working on called Analogy, A Defense of the Cumulative Authority of Science. Have we got that right?
Yeah.
Meaning?
Meaning that, Thomas Kuhn's paradigm theory that somehow science moves from one paradigm to another and makes very little cumulative gain, that each new paradigm usurps and eclipses the previous one. And I believe that true science is best embodied in the advance of technologies, which are demonstrably cumulative.
George Gilder, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
It's just great to have you. Thanks so much for coming in. Jack Beatty, there's an American original for you.
He sure is.
And, I hope I...
and he's right here.
Yes, and he's, he's the prophet, and he takes a lot on faith, and that may not be the best disposition for a man picking stocks.
Well,
all right.
Thank you, Jack.
To me, Jeff.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
I hope I...
With that, we've got to wrap it. George Gilder, thanks for being here. In a moment, one Californian anxiously watches the fire closing in on her hometown. This is On Point. Firefighters are slowly making progress containing the wildfires that have charred a huge swath of Southern California. More than 600,000 acres from San Diego to north of Los Angeles have burned so far. More than 1,500 homes have been destroyed and 16 people have been killed. Californians are certainly no strangers to natural disaster, fire, drought, earthquakes, mudslides. The Golden State has them all. Pat Morrison lives in the hills surrounding Los Angeles. In this radio diary, she remembers the last major fire that hit her hometown 10 years ago and wonders aloud, why do Californians insist on living in the path of nature's fury?
It was Halloween week back then, too, a decade and a day ago, when fire put on its terrifying mask and went trick-or-treating. It went door to door, hot-footing its way up the hillsides and down the canyons, from Altadena to Laguna Beach to Thousand Oaks, and by the time it was finished, nearly 600 houses were gone. Now here it is, Halloween week, and fire has come back, right on schedule. Trick-or-treat, again. Already more than 1,000 buildings are gone, and more than 12 people are dead. The fires aren't even out, and I can tell you now what's going to happen next, once they are. Pretty soon, it'll start to rain. The mud will slip down hills scalped of flora and take a few houses along with it. The bare hillsides will sprout green with new plants, which will grow and dry out and burn all over again. And we'll build more houses in the same places and profess ourselves to be utterly dumbfounded when the cycle starts once more. Insanity, Einstein supposedly said, is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. We, clearly, are no Einsteins. Don't look at me. I live in the hills. I'm as crazy as the rest of you. To all of those people who say L.A. has no seasons, I say, sure we do. We have four of them. Fire, flood, drought, and quake. Fire in these parts is as natural as snow in Vermont, and as important. The fires that can savage vast square miles of chaparral make way for plants to grow. That keeps the flora diverse, which keeps a balance in the animals that feed on the plants, and you see what I'm driving at. It's about as natural as it gets, unlike us. Humans have been fiddling with fires since we got here. Native Americans were torching the place to drive game when Cortez was still in diapers. The postcard come-on of Southern California as a placid paradise, that was a sales pitch that would shame a telemarketer. We bought into it. We still do. We cram ourselves into places that are only habitable because we spend a lot of money to keep them so. A USC professor once told me that this kind of behavior is like a love affair. You get burned once, but you always go back. We are a people, as John McPhee wrote, who would rather defy nature than live without it. Maybe you didn't notice amid the Arnold mania, but in the new state budget, $50 million was just cut from California's Fire Protection Fund. For the first time, the state will be asking homeowners in the flame belts to make up the difference. Every time something in Malibu catches fire or slides downhill or gets walloped by waves, the public posse rides to the rescue, and then there's grumbling from the unscenic flats about the cost of saving the millionaires. "Let Malibu burn," was the incendiary headline on an L.A. Weekly story years ago. Yet these same naggers may themselves be living in the L.A. River's floodplain and getting flood protection for their homes. Taxes on the houses in the fire hills pay for the sandbags in the storm-drenched suburbs. Taxes on houses in the desiccated desert pay for the water-scooping plains for the fire hills. That, too, is a cycle. Does it make us good neighbors or suckers? Ask me next Halloween, when fire goes trick-or-treating again.
Pat Morrison is a columnist with the Los Angeles Times. She lives in the L.A. Hills in California. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.